Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Cosmos Magazine, issue 81. I'm just going to read it from the start and get going through it. So this is issue 1 of 81. And just going through here. Okay, and some of the stuff written by this editor is quite rousing. Last time it was really good. Without change, good things go unnoticed. Without input of new energy, entropy triumphs. Oh dear, that's strange. These statements are true in the publishing game. The issue of Cosmos, we hope, is evidence of the benefits of arising from renewal. This is the first issue published under the aegis of the new home, the Royal Institution of Australia, the first several years without editorial leadership of Elizabeth Finkel. Needless to say, we're aware that there are some mighty huge shoes to fill. But I hope after pursuing these pages, you will think we have largely succeeded in doing so. This is not a clone of the previous Cosmos, but an iteration, if you like, Cosmos 2.0. Many familiar elements, however, remain in this issue. You will find exclusive pieces written by scientists Paul Davis, David Blair, Patrick Nunn, Alan Finkel, and exciting stories written by top-notch scientists, journalists, including various people. You'll find fascinating stories exploring the nexus between science and art, including discussion between two people, both called Alex the Astronaut, although for very different reasons. There are book reviews, because the new energy is good, but one thing we don't want is to change the Cosmos commitment to the readers to be one of the best and most trustworthy sacred magazines in the world. And I would actually say they're actually there. They're on the verge where New Scientist is complete froth. Yeah, I'd say froth. Tantalising froth. I can say, in terms of if you want anything genuine, you have to really sift through it. Okay. Digest. It's called Brexit Seal of Modelling Ice Sheet Collapse. Snap, crackle, and quake. Puff cereal grains have similar properties to rock and ice, which makes them surprisingly useful in trying to understand what happens when ice sheets collapse, the University of Sydney engineers have discovered. All these tends to crush upon interaction with chemically active fluid. Puff grains with milk, rock grains with underground water, and ice with melt water. This is Ita Edelven, who undertook a novel research described in the Journal of Science Advances with colleagues Francois Guillard. In the first place, a sample of cereal in a vertical cylinder and applied constant pressure from top down when fluid was injected to the lower part of the cylinder to soak the cereal, then this is a sudden drop in stress of the system, accompanied by clicking sounds caused by micropores of the cereal being crushed. The whole layer of micropores seemed to crush all at once. They synchronized sound could be heard all around our laboratory. Dubbed rice quakes, these events were caused by dry pack collapsing into the wet. The abrupt collapses kept occurring incrementally, with the delay between quakes increasing as time went on. Some physics-based mathematical model linked the quakes to the flow of liquid into the tiny pores that puffed the rice, making them soggier and weakening over time. By scaling the model up to deal with the timescales of years rather than seconds, the researchers believe it may help understanding the significant collapse of events, such as dams, ice sheets. It is important to note, however, that it may not be accurate for all systems, and particularly those dominated by other physical stresses. Ice quakes, for example, might also be affected by the frictional forces as ice slide along rocky foundations. Well, talk about froth. I think that's getting on towards the frothy end of things. Oh, well, brown Labradors die young. That's an interesting thing. Surprisingly, colour matters when it comes to Labrador longevity. Researchers found that chocolate brown Labradors die younger than yellow-black varieties and also get sicker while they're alive. An Australian study of more than 33,000 Labrador retrievers registered UK veterinary database found that the brown ones have an average lifespan of 10.7 years compared with 12.1 of the others. Just over 61% of the sample dogs had at least one disorder recorded in their database, the most common being a form of ear infection called otitis externa, followed by obesity and degenerative joint disease. Well, Getting fat was colour neutral, affecting 9% of the dogs, but the ear condition was considerably more common with dogs with chocolate coats. The dermatitis was nearly four times more prevalent. A study, which was led by Paul Mungreve, University of Sydney, was reported in the paper published in Canine Genetics and Epidemiology. A separate paper published in the same journal noted that yellow and black Labradors have one of the longest lifespans in the world. West Highland Terriers head the list with an average of 12.7 years, Doberman Pinschers bringing up the rear at 7.6. Okay, sandflies fly high. Science discovered a surprising diet of disease-carrying insect. Sandflies around the world have a strong attraction to cannabis, research has revealed. The team of scientists, led by Ibran Abbas at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Israel, collected insects from five different regions and sequenced the plant material found in their guts. This showed they fed on a variety of plants, but marijuana was by far the most common. It was undoubtedly doubly surprising, first because the consistency of the finding in places distantly separated as Tubas, Palestine, Baja in Brazil, second because all but one site the plant was not visibly common. Therefore, we conclude that cannabis comprises but a small fraction of the available sugar sources in any particular habitat, and that its ample representation among the sandflies plant meals signifies a bona fide attraction. The researchers wrote in the journal's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, one would say that the hats they got cannabis, you know, dealers to do it, things. The researchers wrote in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The reason is not clear, but Apish and colleagues note that there is no psychoactive benefits because sandflies don't possess cannabinoid receptors. There may be clear public health benefits to the finding. In some countries, toxic bakes attract sandflies by mimicking scents of food plants. Adding aroma of cannabis may well increase the efficiency. Sandflies can be deadly. Several species, all from the family Psychodea, transmit the parasite disease Leishmanias, which kills up to 30,000 people a year. Typically, it's transferred to the human bloodstream by female flies, a process that is a two-way street. Insects and humans repeatedly infect each other. I suppose that would also be possibly true for malaria, and it'd be interesting to know what that species is. Da Vinci's bung eye. Optometrists suggested eye disorder helped Leonardo's geniuses. Leonardo da Vinci's artistic genius might have been part of a result of an eye disorder, according to a leading British ophthalmologist. After studying six paintings and drawings and sculptures believed to be the man who painted the Mona Lisa, Christopher Tyler, the University of London, concluded he suffered from strabismus, a misalignment of the eyes. Some forms of eye misalignments are thought to assist artistic work by suppressing the deviating eye, which provides two-dimensional molecular vision advantages to painting and drawing. Writing in the Journal of JAMA Ophthalmology, Tyler suggests that Da Vinci's had intermediate ectropia, a tendency for one eye to turn outwards. This would result in the ability to switch to molecular vision, which may help explain his exceptional talent for capturing space on flat canvas. If he's right, the 15th century master joins an impressive club. Rembrandt, Degas, Picasso are among other artists identified as having strabismus on the basis of eye alignment evident from self-portraits. Other Italian painters, Giovanni Francesco Barry, was even known as Il Gorsino, the squinter. There you go. And you've got Rembrandt, and it's really not Rembrandt's Van Gogh having mental things. And it's really interesting how no much you do, the reality is there, but we can only experience reality through the lens of our own existence. Oh, there's galaxy collisions confirmed. Evidence shows the recent crash of two nearby galaxies. Two satellite galaxies, the Milky Way, its small Magellanic Cloud and Lightning Cloud, collided as recently as a few hundred million years ago, US astronomers have revealed. The unambiguous evidence, they say, is the discovery that all the stars in the southeastern wing of the SMC are moving in a similar direction at roughly the same speed. This is really one of the most exciting results, say, at the University of Michigan. You can actually see that the wing is its own separate region that's moving away from the rest of the SMC. The findings were reported in the paper published in the recent journal Astrophysical Journal Letters. Our and international team used new data from GEO, the Earth, a European Space Agency orbiting telescope, to look for runaway stars that had been ejected from clusters in the SMC. Astronomers at the University of Arizona predicted a few years ago that a direct collision would cause the SMC's wing region to move towards the LMC, whereas if the two galaxies were simply passed near each other, the wing stars would be moving in a perpendicular direction, whatever that means. Instead, Oliver said the wing is moving away from the SMC towards the LMC, confirming direct collision had occurred. I find that, I wish they had explained that a little bit better. I found it interesting. It's really interesting, the number of fantastic nebula in those clouds. I've got to really think about it. Oh, it's interesting here. Archaeology. Early humans had multiple deformities. Analysis of the remains, and it's interesting, the caveman had arthritis, the first skeletons had arthritis, so they used to think that people walked stooped, but it was just a skeleton. Analysis of the remains of ancient humans collected from archaeological sites around the world, they suffered from an astonishing number of physical deformities. The two late Paleolithic infants, 6 children, 4 juveniles, 6 adolescents, 30 prime age adults, and 8 old adults between them showed evidence of 75 skeletal dental anomalies. These include soft bones caused by blood disorder called hypophosphatemia, hydrocephaly, dwarfism, abnormal brain growth, and a wide variety of skull and jaw teeth problems. Or this person could be ripe for dying easily. Anthropologist Eric Trinkus from Washington University, US, stresses the evidence of a disfigurement is not unexpected in people who died out more than 11,000 years ago, but he says the sheer number is no single factor could possibly explain it. So, fairly assumed that these died out left them. He explained, and his submission has vanished the small probability that the total is merely an artifact of comparatively small sample size. The paper published in the Journal of P. Painus, Trinkhouse noted that based on their occurrences of modern populations, the chance of finding evidence of more common anomalies would be something like 5%. The chance of finding rare ones is as little as 0.001%. The chances of finding them in combination or collectively in evidence in every set of remains to date uncovered and reliably dated is astronomical. On the current evidence, he advances some possible reason to account for this finding. One is the generally high levels of stress evidence among the foraging populations in the Lake Palestine area. Another, he tentatively suggests, is inbreeding, or co-sanguinity, as the term uses it. Some anomalies are inherited conditions, and the chances of them being expressed would have been greatly increased if breeding occurred closely related individuals. So, there you go. Now, was it Hubble? Oh. Is Hubble the person who put on a fake English accent? I can't remember. I'll have to remember. Oh, no. There was someone who wanted to disprove Einstein and was a complete arsehole. I just can't remember who he is. There was a fake name after him. Oh, gee, my memory hurts me. Name change corrects historical injustice. One of the most fundamental concepts in cosmology has remained a renamed following a poll of members of the International Astronomical Law, the Hubble Law, which is... No. They don't... gee, the name goes... Henrietta Leavitt. It's not there. But Hubble, which describes the way galaxies move away from each other, is fundamental, and when reviewed in reverse to the theory of the Big Bang, is now known as the Hubble, the Lemaître law. The decision was pretty clear. 78% of 4,600 members who chose to vote, 37% of those eligible supported the proposal. And they have essentially just corrected historical injustice. The law's original name only honours astronomer Erwin Hubble, who provided evidence that the speed at which galaxies have increased in proportion to its distance from Earth, or indeed any given point in the universe. He presented his findings in 1929. However, it's widely acknowledged that his work expanded upon the calculations made by another astronomer, Belgian physicist and priest, Georges Lemaître, and published 2 years earlier. And yeah, that's confusing. I'm just really trying to think of this horrible, horrible man. There was an absolutely horrible man who tried to disprove Einstein. Milliken. He was just complete not. But I think Hubble is also pretty obnoxious person. Dinos laid the first coloured eggs. Speckles and tints evolved long before birds. Birds are the only egg layers that produce coloured eggs, but contrary to previous assumptions, that's not the avian innovation, according to US researchers. While using Raman spectroscopy to analyse fossilised eggshells from all the major dinosaur groups, a team led by Jasmina Wiseman, a Yale University in the US, found traces of migrants in a group of small, bipedal and often feathered animals known as Maniraptoria. None of these eggs, and none was found in eggs of any other types, leading them to conclude the egg colour had evolutionary origin in the non-avian theropod dinosaurs. As with many other characteristics of this attribute, can be evolved deep within the dinosaur tree long before the spectacular radiation of modern birds. The researcher wrote in an article published in the journal Nature. They suggest pigmentation may have evolved in response to environmental cues, with colouring giving a selective advantage to eggs left uncovered or unburied. But larger samples are needed to be sure. I think, doesn't that really say everything? Mars makes rocket fuel. What is it? I think... Mars is actually covered with antiseptic rocket fuel. It's pretty amazing. One of the ingredients humans need to make in order to travel to Mars is already there in abundance. And now scientists think they know why. Plasma chemistry. Laboratory studies in the US suggest perchlorates. That's what they add. I think there's a chlorate, heaps of oxygen. Adds with some sort of... oil. I've got to remember what that rocket fuel is. Perchlorates makes it completely, you just don't have any life if perchlorates there. The toxic chemical compound used in rocket fuels and fertilizers to create it naturally in the red planet from static electricity inside storms and whirlwinds known as dust devils. The strong electric fields break down the gases in the atmosphere, researchers suggest. This drives reactions to create perchlorates at the rate that could be as much as 10 million times higher than those driven by sunlight. Well, there you go. It's interesting. And that's significant because that means that the fact that you've got so many perchlorates there is that it's just the dust settling on it. Okay. Significantly, because both sunlight is the catalyst used on Earth to create them, and because perchlorates have an important impact on Mars' habitability, which means the inhabitable. To test the theory, researchers created a mini-Mars combining 95% carbon dioxide, 2% nitrogen, 2% argon, 1% oxygen in large chambers to simulate the atmosphere. They added a salt as a source of chlorinated and decreased the temperature and pressure. When the mixture was exposed to electric field of the right magnitude, some of the gases quickly broke down to form highly reactive, positively charged versions of carbon monoxide and nitrogen molecules. Over time, substantial amounts of perchlorates and perchlorates were created. Finding was reported in a paper published in Earth and Planetary Sciences Letter. Well, that is interesting because it means that there's an origin for perchlorates, and so it could be a frosting of perchlorates. Okay. The beer apocalypse is coming. Climate change could impact barley supplies, modelling shows. Quenching your thirst with cold beer is likely to become more difficult and expensive in years when drought heat waves coincide. Surely it does. Global supply might drop as much as 16% if barley crops are depleted, according to the paper published in the journal Nature Plants. Beer is the world's most popular drink, but it's still a luxury group, and probably we will have to pay second fiddle if available barley is needed for feeding humans and animals, says researcher at the China Center for Agricultural Policy in Peking University in Beijing. If the availability of fresh water declines, the situation could even be more dire, since the study didn't forecast the impact decreasing availability on barley yields. Quote, our results reflect impacts of extreme events as though they happened in today's world, says researcher Wei Zai Wei. The team used weather formations from 81 to 2010 to determine the threshold for 100 years global droughts and heat waves, combining this with global economic models, crop information, and future climate scenarios. They found, just how ridiculous would you ever report this? They found that strategies in global land found that the average global land surface temperature increased. There was also a steady increase in the frequency and magnitude of coinciding extreme drought and heat events during barley growing seasons. Concurrent extremes of drought and heat can be anticipated to cause both substantial decrease in beer consumption and increase in beer price. I just think they really had nothing. They just added it to beer. Why not? That really upsets me. Yeah, if I talk about beer, I can publish anything. Okay. Aussie streams full of pharma. Scientists have a sobering new evidence of how manufactured chemicals are infiltrating the food chain. Aquatic animals taken from 6 streams near Melbourne in Australia contained more than 60 pharmaceutical compounds, including antidepressants. And the international team only screened for 98 compounds to come up with their haul. More than 900 medicines are subsidised under national pharmaceutical benefit schemes. Chemist Erin Richmond from Monash University, who led a study, says the concentration of drugs found in stream journaling invertebrates like yabbies suggests large animals that eat them may be exposed to drugs to level up to half those of human therapeutic doses. Our research is significant because we can confirm many pharmaceuticals are accumulating in the aquatic invertebrates, but are also leaving the stream and moving to surrounding landscape, where they are consumed by spiders, potentially birds and bats, for example, she said. The study, which was described in the paper published in the Journal of Nature Communications, looked at the impact on two predators, the platypus and the brown trout, and found sufficient evidence to raise concern. At least that was well put. Okay. New particles may turn physics upside down. A handful of particles erupting from ice in Antarctica may be the first indication of something entirely new. Scientists know about cosmic rays which strike the ground from space, but NASA's Antarctic Impulsive Transient Antenna Anita has spotted particles emanating from the ground. It's just something energetic has travelled through the planet, a phenomenon that's hard to explain. The intriguing finding is reported in physical review letters by the team led by Graham Peter Gorman at the University of Hawaii in the US. Anita has a ray of radio antenna dangling from balloons 35 metres above the ground. It circumnavigates Antarctica, detecting dangling from balloons 35, whatever that means, Antarctica cosmic ray showers, in particular ultra high energy cosmogenic neutrinos, as they collide with the ice below. So this is, the radio antenna is floating above the ice. Wow. The first flight detected 16 such events, and hidden in the data was a single UHECR detected from below the horizon of the ice, from the ice, without any polarization from reflection. This was noted, but evidence wasn't strong enough to rule out the ice shell, ice itself as a source. In the third flight, 20 UHECRs were detected, again including a single one detected from ice without reflective polarization. The events now suggest that high energy particles have travelled all the way through the planet, creating a burst of radio waves in the ice, like an upside down cosmic ray. While standard neutrinos are capable of flying through light years of solid lead, their high energy counterparts have a greater chance of collision. In fact, EHECR spotted by Anita's can't possibly have travelled through the Earth without collision, at least according to Stanford model particle, standard model of particle physics. Possible solutions include interaction beyond the standard model, or even entirely new particles, such as sterile neutrinos. Well, that's really interesting. I find neutrinos absolutely fascinating. So they're the sister particle of an electron. They're basically a chargeless electron. It's quite interesting. You know, so your charges are minus one, or plus two-thirds, or minus a third, or zero. Quite fascinating. All of you look harder for E.T. NASA Tom. All future NASA missions should incorporate astrobiology from the get-go, and organisations should expand a range of possible ET indicators to try. It tries to detect, according to NASA-sponsored reports. It was prepared by the U.S. National Academies of Science, Engineering, Medicine, and written by a specifically appointed committee of academics under the leadership of geologist Barbara Sherwood-Lawler from Canada's University of Toronto. Other members included astrobiologist Victoria Meadows from the University of Washington, geoscientist James Casting from Pennsylvania State University, and chemical biologist Jared Joyce from the Salk Institute of Biological Studies, all in the US. The committee recommended that the current lines of evidence used to search for extraterrestrial life called biosignatures be expanded, in particular protocols that needed to establish to detect so-called agnostic varieties, evidence that may indicate the presence of life forms that do not share any molecular or metabolic similarities found on Earth. The report also recommends improved frameworks to aid distinction between living and non-living phenomena, and to improve understanding of how the biosignatures may persist over long periods of time. Special attention should be paid to planning future NASA missions to detecting possible sparsely distributed life, such as rock-eating microbes, and life that may exist beneath the surface of a planet. In terms of engineering, the report recommends ramping up the effort to design mission-ready life detection technologies. The orders specify the development of instruments for in-space and near-ground missions capable of suppressing ambient starlight to better enable the imaging of possible ET-friendly environments. I think that's just... Isn't that madness? Isn't that not sheer madness? Surely you can just breathe a sigh of relief. I think I am alone. I think loneliness is a necessary gift to can be in a crowd and feel alone. We can be, we're in a crowded university, but we're, it's a universe, but we're in the dump area of it. Shark passes the Turing test, and that's interesting. A reaction diffusion model works for ancient fish as well as vertebrates. Alan Turing's explanation of how modern animals develop scales, feathers, hair may have broader application. Research. What? Turing's, not Turing's, not Turing, it's Turing. Okay, so research suggests his famous reaction diffusion model also explains the development of sharks' tooth-like skin. So they've got little... that's significant, according to zoologist Roy Cooper at the University of Sheffield, UK, because although previous research had found the report of RT patterning of four-legged animals is a role in more ancient, earlier diverging lineages also became clearer. Widely known as the Turing model, RD is a theoretical construct that describes self-regulated pattern formation in developing animal embryo. It explains the progression of epithelial appendices, external structures such as hair, feathers, scales, spines and teeth, over the past 45,000 million years, a time frame that spans the evolution of vertebrates. The structures all possess similar developmental positioning in relation to each other because they grow from a common foundation. The thickness areas of epithelium, known as the palicoids, in their work described in the paper published, Science Advances, Cooper and colleagues studied small spotted cat shark and two ancient Catalinish fishes and thornback skate and little skate, using RD modelling and gene expression analysis. The modelling showed the emergence of initiated rows that triggered patterning of the surrounding skin, producing tooth-like structures. The researchers noted the patterning, also governed by protein, also implicated in the development of a palicoid signalling the bird chicks, confirming Turing's model was in play. We proposed a diverse range of vertebrate appendages, from shark tentacles to avian feathers to mammalian hair, use the ancient and conserved system with slight genetic modulations accounting for a broad variety of patterning, they conclude. So yeah, it's pretty amazing that the same basic, like your skin has got hair all over it. Oh my, it does. Mine does, and so it's pretty amazing that it's there. Okay, could green life, the climate, cold green life, the climate scientists balancing Antarctic research with sustainability? Nerli Abran is a scientist, a leader, and a mother, and a gardener. Above all, she is certain climate change is happening. Often the science can sound like we're still figuring things out, she said, but knowing how much we do know now, how clear the evidence is, makes me concerned. We definitely are experiencing climate change right now. Is it having impacts right now? And those impacts are getting worse if we don't get on top of and solving the problem. The paleoclimatologist at the Australian National University in Canberra, Abraham, recently returned from a summer in Antarctica. She worked near the Davison Station, a permanent base in Australia's Antarctic Division, to drill a 300-metre ice core, a time capsule that allowed her to look at Earth's climate over millennia. Now 41, she always loved nature, but took a first year geology course at the University of Sydney to catapult her into a world full of earth sciences. After the undergraduate degree, she moved to ANU and a PhD focused on studying tropical corals and see how climate had changed over time. Every year the coral glows leaves a band, the skeleton, exactly the same way trees have rings. Analysing the core section of the skeleton, climate scientists can determine the ocean's temperature when the coral was growing. With lifespans of hundreds of years, coral can show when warming began and what the natural variability is and how we are now pushing the ocean outside the normal range. Abraham then found herself in the British Antarctic Survey at Cambridge studying ice cores. How did you find yourself? Oh, hello, who's that? Oh, that's me. Oh. The frozen time machines allowed her to look not only at temperature, but also at its past atmosphere, ocean salinity, and volcanic activity. We can look at the composition of bubbles in ancient atmosphere within the ice core. And that's where we get our records of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere prior to when we started measuring 60 years ago, she says. It gives an important perspective to climate change. We're starting to understand the extent of how far we've changed the system. Back at ANU, Abrahams is studying tropical frozen samples. This mix takes her to far-flung places such as Indonesia, Antarctica, Greenland and Christmas Island, and gives her a big picture overview of the change of climate. The climate is all connected, she says. Things that happen in the tropics actually have an impact on the climate in Antarctica. So what does the past tell us? Quote, in the past we can see the climate has changed naturally, she says. Now we have long-term warming of the climate that's begun as early as the mid-1800s. Comparing the natural record with the climate model shows that on average the world has warmed 1 degree Celsius per since pre-industrial times, and that the changes are, quote, only consistent with greenhouse gases that humans have been putting into the atmosphere. The record shows that we are close to exceeding the target set in the Paris Agreement, which aims to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius. Abraham says there are good reasons why the targets were set. They're based on records that show that the level of past warming impacted the Earth in the past. She thinks that we should also try our hardest to meet these targets. We're likely to overshoot them before cooling the world again and developing new technologies to put carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But we can't rely on future selves. Quote, there are already destructive and damaging impacts of climate change happening right now, she said. The worse that we let the problem get, the more impacts we see. Humanity may push systems into states they can't bounce back from. For example, the Great Barrier Reef may reach a point where it cannot recover from marine heat waves and bleaching. Identifying these tipping points is extremely difficult, but they do exist, and we are in danger of dropping them. There's a real urgency to the current situations about that may require Abraham's team, the climate scientists around the world, to work outside the traditional boundaries of their research to develop solutions. Everyone, she believes, has a role to play, including individuals. What? Her family tries to live greenly. They have just moved into a new house and plan to put their solar panels and ride to work and school. Well, there you go. She said it's difficult to balance green ideas with reality. I struggle with the same things that other people struggle with. My work involves travelling, and I know that something is making the problem worse. Abraham and her husband also grappled with the ethics of having 3 children. She knows their choice contributes to the overall problem, and yet the knowledge drives her passion, striving to make sure her kids have a livable future. She recently began working with the International Governmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which provides policy measures with information about climate change risks. At British Antarctica Society, she also had plenty of chances to communicate with influential people, ranging from business leaders to royalty. Quote, Prince Charles came and was given a tour, end quote, she recalled. We took him into the freezer and gave him some ice to hold and to look at the bubbles of recent air trapped from within the Antarctic ice. She admits that sometimes, quote, there are days which you wonder if you're really working and making a difference, particularly when you see political statements that don't seem to be taking account of the science, end quote. It's frustrating, she says, the evidence of climate change has existed for decades, yet so little progress has been made, quote, it worries me that to what it actually take for the apparent that we can't just continue on as we've been doing. The bottom line is that we already need for reducing emissions. She's also aware of why many people shut down when confronted with this urgent issue. Well, this has been news to me. Why do people shut down? The real balance between making sure you're communicating the extent of the problem and how real it is, how serious it is, that's happening right now, but not making but also making sure that you don't leave people with a sense of helplessness. That includes when talking to her own children, aged 12, 9, 12 or 14, she strives to balance the telling the truth with worrying them too much. Overall, she's had the impression the younger generation has a much more educated understanding about how the Earth works and climate problems around them, which is, of course, a hope. She's not convinced we will reduce emissions enough to meet the Paris targets, but she believes you must remain optimistic. Quote, if people feel hopeless about the problem, then we won't come up with a solution. Climate change is a huge problem, but it isn't an impossible problem. For the next year, Sabrin and her collaborators around the world will work on analysing the ice sheet cores recently brought back from Antarctica, with the hope of learning more about the Indian Ocean winds have influenced rainfall in southern Australia. This could shed new light on the Millennium Drought, a low rainfall event that heavily impacts southern Australia between 2001 and 2009 and help prepare for more extreme events. Abraham is also part of the Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes at the Australian Consortium, focusing on droughts, heat waves and extreme rainfall, the types of things that affect people. The thing that drove me towards this area of research was knowing that I'm working on a project that is important, and questions we're answering are important for people right now. Okay. Now, meet the world's largest flying launch pad. My godfather, that is a huge plane. Look at that. Okay. Paul Allen co-founded Microsoft, but the Strato launch has become his greatest. But will the Strato launch? Microsoft. Bill Gates. Isn't it amazing? Like an hour or a year ago, I'd be searching for a day to get their name. Okay, Kath O'Connell reports. Looking like two planes stitched together at their wingtips, Strato launch is perhaps not the slickest aircraft ever built, but it is the biggest, at least by wingspan. Its record lift capacity could prove a game changer on how we get to space. This is because Strato launch is designed to carry rockets high into the atmosphere and release them just before they ignite their engines and blast into space. Meet the world's largest flying launch pad, founded in 1911 by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, who died in October this year. Strato launch aims to turn the satellite launching into an audacious spectacle to a routine takeoff. Taking off from a runway is cheaper and more versatile than launching from the ground and less mercy of inclement weather. Obviously, starting from a height saves fuel, freeing up room for payload. But there's also the efficiency boost because the rocket doesn't need to push its way through a relatively thick atmosphere into the ground. And you get to choose the nozzle design that works really well at high altitude rather than compromise with something that works okay near the ground. Coupled with a reusable rocket, Strato launch could potentially put small satellites into low Earth orbits for less than SpaceX can achieve with self-landing boosters. Or surely you can have self-landing stuff like that. Futuristic as it sounds, have been air launching rockets for 70 odd years. When Chuck Yeager broke the sound record in 1947 in his Bell X rocket plane that had been dropped and launched from the bottom of a B-24 bomber. Yet Yeager's rocket plane was small, just 5,500 kilograms including fuel. To air launch a rocket carrying enough fuel to reach space, and with the distant satellite payload in now, you need an absurdly large aircraft. Well, Strato launch is an absurdly large aircraft. It's powered by six 747 engines scavenged from three 747s. It has 28 wheels and wingspan of 1,117 metres, the length of a soccer field, equivalent to three 737s sitting wingtip to wingtip. That's far longer than the current record of 98 metres held by Hughes Hercules, the so-called Spruce Fleet, which only managed a short hop before being placed on permanent storage. At the moment, they're testing Strato launch to see if it can reach takeoff speed of 2,220 km/h without breaking apart. Its first takeoff is planned in 2019. The only question is, can the Big Bird fly? Oh, there you go. And it's specified, so its length is 73 metres, its wingspan is 117, the height is 75 metres. It can take a good, looks like half a ton of payload. It looks completely stupid. Can I say that looks like a stupid plane? The payload, the camera, twin fuel loads, the extra high wing position. The shuttle launch cuts a strange figure under the high central wing in between the two cockpits, one of which will be manned. There's enough room to carry a rocket the size of the space shuttle, and with room to spare, its 250-ton payload matches the current record set by the Russian Antonov 225, which has a designer to piggyback the Buran space plane, the Russian version of NASA's space shuttle. How much we'll get to orbit depends on the rocket, but planned medium launch vehicle heavy could lift as much as 6 tons of satellites into low orbit, and that is far less than many typical rockets. The SpaceX Falcon Heavy launches 64 tons, but satellite launches looking to reliability and efficiency to give an edge in the small satellite market. Oh God. Lift. The plane is generally genuinely has the engine power of 3 jumbo jets. Its 6 Pratt & Whitney turbofan engines were scavenged from 747s along with Atlantic Gear electricals and much of the cockpit and much more as a way of keeping down costs. Flight plan. Paul Allen's was a self-confessed space nut. Carrying out his plans, his company tends to run weekly airport-style repeatable services, but the efficiency boost from airlift, taking off and runway gives you another huge advantage over rocket launch scheduling. While rocket launches are often delayed due to any sign of bad weather, a plane can simply fly around the bad patch and let go of the rocket in clearer skies. Then there are the versatility of launching rockets from any airport as long as it has a 3.7-kilometer runway. Initially, Stratolaunch is aiming for 12 or more missions per year. Another billionaire-backed spaceflight company, Richard Branson Virgin Galactic, is working with air launch design, but with an age of 10-ton space plane designed only to ferry rich tourists to the edge of space, not to put cargo into orbit. That's just so stupid. Okay, that's the end of this podcast. Next is lead scientist of the Royal Institution of Australia. See how this goes. Okay, we'll keep on going.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.